disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Don Bolin, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 22nd, 23rd issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The headline reads, an MIT student, odd top economist, with his AI study, then it all fell apart. Aidan Toner Rogers, shot to academic fame in a field hungry for few insights and revelatory research. Now the university is left figuring out how to prevent further scandals. Aidan Toner Rogers, 27, sprang to the upper tiers of economics as a graduate student late last year from virtually out of nowhere, while still making core classes at the MIT school. He wrote a paper on artificial intelligence, workplace impact, so rapidly influential it was cited in Congress. He appeared in the pages of the Wall Street Journal in December as the very picture of her wonderkind, in faded jeans with tousled hair, in between two of his mentors, including Nobel insert Darren Amagolin. Toner Rogers' work offered a surprising and even hopeful revelation about our high-tech future. He concluded that AI increased worker productivity and spurred innovation. Also, people didn't like using it very much. Within weeks, those mentors were asking an unthinkable question. Had Toner Rogers made it all up? By the spring, Toner Rogers was no longer enrolled at MIT. The university disavowed his paper. Questions multiplied, but one seemed more elusive than the rest. How did a baby-faced novice from small-town California dupe some of the academia's brightest minds? There is no world where this makes any sense, said David Autor, one of the MIT professors who had previously championed his students' research. MIT Autor and Akamologu declined to comment on it, the specifics actually of the investigation into the research, citing privacy constraints. Toner Rogers' illusory success seems in part thanks to the dynamics he has now upset an academic culture at MIT, where high levels of trust, integrity, and rigor are all, for better or worse, assumed. He focused on AI, a field where peer-reviewed research is still in its infancy, and the hunger for data is insatiable. What has stunned his former colleagues and mentors is the sheer breadth of his apparent deception. He didn't just tweak a few variables. It appears he invented the entire study. In the aftermath, MIT economics professors have been discussing ways to raise standards for graduate students' research papers, including scrutinizing raw data, and students are going out of their way to show their work isn't counterfeit, according to people of the school. Since parting with the university, Toner Rogers has told other students that his paper's problems were essentially a mirror issue with data rights. According to him, he had indeed burrowed into a drove of data from a large material science company, as his paper said he did. But instead of getting formal permission to use the data, he faked a data use agreement after the company wanted to pull out. He told other students by way of a WhatsApp message in May. Toner Rogers didn't return multiple calls and messages to his family members also went unreturned. This next subhead is entitled Hooked on Economics. When Tony Rogers arrived on the MIT campus in 2023, he joined a cadre of researchers, theorists, and academics whose work has shaped the global economy at the highest level, with Nobel winning alumni, including Ben Bernanke and Robert Shiller. Getting in is a feast in itself. Of the approximately 800 who apply each year for the Economics Department PhD program, only 40 are accepted, with 20 to 24 enrolling. It was a fortuitous rise. Tony Rogers was raised in Sebastopol, a sleepy town in California's wine country, along with four siblings. His dad taught second grade, and his mom ran a music school. Those who knew him said he was smart and had no serious history of getting in trouble in or outside of school. He's from a beautiful, sunny place in America, and I think he had a nice upbringing, said Miles D'Alessandro, a college friend. As a kid, he had a pretty good jump shot, and by 2017 was playing as a guard for McAllister College's Division III basketball team in St. Paul. He also played tennis and was popular among his teammates. McAllister is a small school of about 2,000 students, and outside of his teammates, he tended to keep to himself, former students said. McAllister was also where Tony Rogers got hooked on economics. He was drawn to the field because of the data and research element of economics. Just being able to dive into the mechanics of how the economy is working, D'Alessandro said. Tony Rogers excelled at the program. He won scholarships, mentored other students, and co-authored a paper with one of his economics professors, Felix Freit. From the outset, Tony Rogers seemed destined for his sterling career. In 2021, he landed a two-year job at the New York Fed, where he helped write research that was published in the Journal of Applied Econometrics. From the outset, Tony Rogers seemed destined for a sterling career. In 2021, he landed a two-year job at the New York Fed, where he helped write research that was published in the Journal of Applied Economics and on the Regional Central Bank's own closely watched blog. The research Tony Rogers did at the New York Fed hasn't been challenged. In 2023, when he started the PhD program in MIT, Tony Rogers seemed to fit in just fine. He played in an informal basketball league, went to classes, did the coursework, and worked as a teaching assistant without drawing too much attention to himself, according to students who knew him. He felt different in one way. So many people in my program, one parent was in academia, or they're a doctor in something, he told the Journal last year. The family in which he grew up was a very intellectual household, but definitely not people who pursued a ton of career stuff. MIT is an enclave even within the hermetic world of Cambridge academia, a place where complex, bleeding-edge ideas spawn from sterile labs and filthy dorm rooms. At the economics department, it's also a place with a surprising reputation for collegiality. But the stakes were high. Current and former MIT graduate students described a range of pressure to do revelatory research. One said some professors there expected bigger work earlier than ever from PhD candidates. Tony Rogers' fellow PhD candidates included students who were working with major governments and one who ran a nonprofit. In the summer before Turner Rogers arrived, two published a groundbreaking study on AI in the journal Science. Near the end of his first semester, Turner Rogers told some friends he had stumbled on an interesting lead. Turner Rogers said an old classmate worked at a large company in the field of materials science, a branch of engineering that invents novel forms of matter that can be used in technologies like biomedical devices. He told the other students that he might be able to access data from a large AI experiment this friend had told him about. Tony Rogers told the journal a similar story last year. I was like, oh, that's so cool, he said then. And then I went through the whole nightmarish process of getting the data. The booming industry of AI is like catnip to economics researchers. It's a new, it's rich in information and holds the potential to rearrange the economy. By the next semester, Tony Rogers pitched the idea to Otter, a leading labor economist and self-described computer geek who for years had been mulling how AI might shape employment. After that, friends say Tony Rogers was focused on his research. He presented a preliminary version on June 4th, 2024, when a slot opened up at a lunchtime lecture series. The event was typically a showcase for more experienced doctoral candidates where students and faculty from across the university could see them present their work. He seemed confident as he explained his work for the first time. Amargola attended. Before a group of roughly two dozen students and professors, he described the introduction of an AI tool rolled out into 1,018 scientists in a lab focused on tweaking molecular recipes for materials at a large, unnamed U.S. company. With the AI tool, he said, scientists could specify the characteristics they'd like a compound to have, and the tool would generate recipes the scientists would pick from. According to his paper, researchers discovered more materials, filled more new patents, and saw an increase in prototypes. But what was revelatory wasn't just that AI could make work easier, it was that the benefits mostly went to scientists who were already the most successful. Tony Rogers continued to work on the paper over the summer. Later versions included a survey that he said showed the scientists were broadly unsatisfied with the AI tool despite the improvements in the productivity. I couldn't help feeling that much of my education is now worthless, the paper quoted one scientist as saying. Tony Rogers' supposed findings contrasted with the more optimistic view of Otter, who thinks that AI could help narrow income disparities by allowing more people to do work that can now only be performed by highly trained specialists. But the research also countered the pessimism of Anamabulo, who is skeptical about AI's ability to make workers more productive. It resembled the messiness of real life. In November 2024, Tony Rogers presented the findings at a seminar held by the National Bureau of Economic Research, the world's premier economics research organization, where it was well received. That same month, the paper was cited in congressional testimony. Weeks later, the science journal Nature highlighted it. The last version was posted on Archive, a global repository for unpublished science research in December. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. I'll continue to the story. This next section is entitled Things Fall Apart. Around this time, the paper showed up in the inbox of a University of California, San Diego computer scientist named Charles Elkann. To him, the research seemed off. Elkann used to work as a managing director of Goldman Sachs and as a scientist at Amazon, where he led machine learning teams. The technology sounded too good to be true to him, given its supposed data of deployment. Also, 3M and Corning were the only U.S. materials companies Elkann knew of that employed a large number of scientists. And he questioned why, if they were inventing so many new materials, they would be keeping it a secret. On January 5th, a week after Tony Rogers appeared in the journal, Elkann wrote an email to Otter and Amargola, raising questions about the paper's academic integrity. If any company develops a software like this that is so valuable, they should be boasting about it, he said in an interview. The professors started to investigate. At this point, university economics departments had mostly been spared of the scandals that have hit other fields, including materials science, where a blockbuster finding on room temperature superproductivity was invalidated in 2023. While a paper's methodology could do more or less rigorous and data could be tortured into fitting preconceived conclusions, the falsification of an entire study was an extraordinary. Meanwhile, the case was about to reach a United Nations agency that adjudicates copyright disputes. On January 31st, Corning filed a complaint with the World Intellectual Property Organization against the registrar of the domain named CorningResearch.com. Someone who controlled that domain name would potentially create email addresses or web pages that gave the impression they were affiliated with the company. WIPO soon found that Tony Rogers had apparently registered the domain name according to the organization's written decision on the case. Tony Rogers never responded to the complaint, and Corning successfully won the transfer of the domain name. WIPO declined to comment. Otter and Amargola brought the case to MIT's Committee on Discipline in February. Tony Rogers stopped showing up to classes around this time, according to two former classmates. To some friends, he said he was interviewing with OpenAI and acted like nothing was wrong. A public ledger of his Venue account shows him paying friends back for dinners and a ticket to a Boston Celtics game. At a party in April, he seemed tired but was still talking about the success of his paper, one classmate said. Even as his professors at MIT were questioning his research, Tony Rogers continued to promote it. On March 5th, he presented at a virtual workshop on materials science and AI held by the Materials Research Society. In May, MIT released a statement disavowing Tony Rogers' paper, saying it has no confidence at the provenance, reliability, or validity of the data, and has no confidence in the veracity of the research contained in the paper. While the statement didn't name Tony Rogers directly, it said the author is no longer at MIT. Some of those who knew Tony Rogers said they were blindsided by the news. Friend then The McAllister economics professor who co-authored a paper with him said he was shocked and dismayed when he heard. It's a very sad development, he added. In the WhatsApp chat in May, in which Tony Rogers told other students he had faked the data use agreement, he wrote, "This was a huge and embarrassing act of dishonesty on my part. Said in hindsight, it clearly would have been better to just abandon the paper." Both Corning and 3M told the journal that they didn't roll out the experiment. Tony Rogers described in that they didn't share data with him. The journal reviewed two earlier drafts of Tony Rogers' work, one from April 2024, the other from September 2024. The April version has data that conflicts with later versions and shows small changes that could have raised questions from his mentors. Asked whether he had seen the earlier draft, Otter said he couldn't comment, but that these are legitimate questions. The April draft said the scientists at the materials science company worked on 421 teams. In the draft 5 months later, the number of teams fell to 221. It also said more than three quarters of idea generation came from AI, while the latter draft lowered that to 57%. Now the professor is grappling with the blind spots that Tony Rogers has exposed. In the future, of course, people will become more paranoid in economics, Amagola said. This next article is entitled Inside the World of AI Song Making, Big Hits and a Seven-Figure Deal. Talisha Nikki Jones grew up steeped in gospel, blues, and R&B. She sang in a choir and wrote poetry. "But becoming a full-time artist was never a dream of mine," she said. That all changed in September after she used an artificial intelligence song generator to transform one of her poems into a tearjerker called "How Was I Supposed to Know?" Jones credited the release to an avatar also created with AI named Zana Monet. The track brought her the type of attention that most aspiring artists long for. She hit number 20 on Billboard's Hot R&B Songs chart and signed a seven-figure recording deal, according to people familiar with the negotiations. "I grew up singing in church," said Jones, who owns a print design shop in Holly Springs, Mississippi, "but I can't do vocals as powerful as what I created with Zana." At least 10 AI songs have charted recently, according to Billboard. Another, breaking Rust's throaty country blues track, "Walk My Walk," recently reached number 2 on Spotify's Global Viral 50 ranking. The song is credited to a writer named Aubrey Rivaldo Taylor. He hasn't done interviews, but his music was identified as AI-generated by the streaming service Deezer, which started to tag these songs on its platform in January. Spotify does not currently label tracks made with AI, though the company said in a recent blog post that it is helping develop and will support the new industry standard for AI disclosures and music credits. The arrival of commercially viable songs made almost entirely with AI marks an inflection point for the music industry, and it has set off heated debates. Some labels want to sign the creators behind these songs, but the biggest record companies like Universal Music Group, Sony Music Entertainment, and Warner Music Group have taken legal action against two leading song generators. Some musicians have said they detest AI music, but casual listeners may not care how a track is made if they find it catchy. "These are artists who feel a lot of frustration and concern," said Michael Jacob, chief executive and co-founder of Lemonade, an AI tool that creates music loops rather than full tracks for producers. These are song generator platforms that are going to compete with them. The R&B singer Kalani recently told her TikTok followers that nothing and no one on earth will ever be able to justify AI to me. SZA, a five-time Grammy winner, was more succinct on the Instagram in September. I hate AI. Song generators have improved rapidly in the last 2 years, making it increasingly hard to distinguish their output from a track made by an artist in a studio. There's a pretty decent-sized percentage of people out there who can't tell the difference between an AI-generated song version versus a human-made one, said Abe Barchon, chief executive of BeatStars, an online marketplace where artists can buy instrumentals. But the recently charting AI tracks haven't yet proved their staying power. Novelty is a big part of their appeal. Several AI songs cracked genre-specific sales charts, but that might only require around 1,000 downloads, not a huge listener base. How was I supposed to know? Fell off the R&B ranking in its second week. Jones made her breakout time or tune using Suno, one of the most prominent song generators. Last year, the major labels sued the company, accusing it of training its technology on their tracks without permission. Suno, which did not respond to a request for comment, has said that its training practices are protected under the doctrine known as fair use. The suit has not stopped people from playing around with the platform, which recently raised $250 million at a valuation of $2.45 billion. Drew Meadows relies on Suno to make country rap, and three of his songs have earned more than 1 million streams apiece on Spotify. I create my own lyrics and plug them in, he explained. I label each section, verse, chorus, bridge, and then I give Suno direction on the musical style. Users can be incredibly specific with their prompts. And after Suno whips up a made-to-order song, they can continue to fiddle with the results, trying to refine the output until it matches their initial vision. I sometimes go through 100 songs on Suno to get one song to release, Jones said. Neil Jacobson, a former president of Geffen Records, describes acts having success with Suno as music designers. They're out there in the zero barrier to entry in internet, creating a groundswell that is allowing them to make a living, he said. That should be celebrated. He signed Jones and others to his company, Hollywood Media, which also participated in Suno's recent fundraising round through its venture arm. But Jacobson has taken heat for these signings from some of the more traditional acts on his roster, as well as other executives and firebrands online. So has Jones. I've got people in my inbox calling me names, telling me to go to die. For decades, technology has been replacing human functions in recording, making it progressively easier and cheaper for amateurs to turn out commercial tracks, even if they're not gifted singers or producers. Now, tech has advanced to the point that it's possible to create a song with almost no human input, aside from a few text prompts. It's scary how good AI music creation is getting, said Jeremy Misiak, an artist manager and former major label A&R. What is scarier is that the consumer doesn't seem to mind. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next story is entitled, Sharing Data About Friendliness Helps Young People Make Friends. The college years once ranked among the happiest times of most people's lives, but that's changed. Young adults face an escalating mental health crisis, fueled in part by loneliness. In 2023, 19% of young adults reported having no one they could count on, compared to less than 14% in 2006. When explaining this trend, it's tempting to turn to stereotypes. Phone-addled, self-obsessed kids these days have forgotten how to connect. A new study from our lab tells a different story. We surveyed thousands of students at Stanford University, where we both work, and discovered two different schools. The first Stanford was made of real students who defy tidy put-downs of kids these days. Undergraduates were near the top of the scale in empathy. 95% said they would help peers who were feeling down, and nearly 90% wanted to befriend students they didn't know. The second Stanford group was a colder, pricklier place that lived inside students' minds. Students vastly underestimated how empathetic, kind, and friendly their average peer was. This empathy perception gap didn't stay in students' heads. Undergraduates who thought the least of their peers also asked the least of them. They were less likely to strike up conversations with classmates or confide in doormates. This, in turn, predicted loneliness, isolation, and unhappiness. Perception gaps are not unique to Stanford. Dozens of studies find that people underestimate how kind, trustworthy, and open-minded others are. The studies also find that these cognitive errors stand in the way of social life. We imagine a stranger on the train will put their headphones on when we chat them up, so we stay silent even though most people are uplifted by conversation. We think our request will burden friends, so we don't ask even though most people are thrilled to help. The U.S. faces a dire connection shortage, but the issue is demand, not supply. People are waiting to help, commune, and commiserate, but not enough of them are asking for what they need. This is also an opportunity. If people underestimate one another, then connecting might simply be a matter of seeing each other more clearly. At Stanford, our team acted on this prediction. In target dorms on campus, we hung posters that presented accurate data about the percent of undergraduates who wanted to help and befriend others. We also ran education campaigns where students confronted their perception gaps and reflected on new ways to reach out to peers. Students in those dorms versus controlled houses underestimated others less. Like the perception gap, these new beliefs took root in students' actions. Students who saw our campaign were more willing to take social risks, such as complimenting peers, expressing gratitude, and asking for help when they needed it. It worked. 6 months later, these students reported more friendships than those who had not seen the campaign. Stanford is just one community, an unusual one at that. We can't be sure that similar efforts would work elsewhere, nor do we think that perception gaps are the only source of isolation. You can find cruel, judgmental, and unkind people everywhere, but decades of research also show that the average person underestimates the average person. Increasingly, we do so at our own peril, retreating into screens that bombard us with even more fearsome stories of others, which causes us to retreat even further. Study after study finds that when we step into real interactions, moods lift and connection comes naturally. Our work suggests that to encourage people to take that step It's helpful to first give them a chance to see others' empathy and care just by presenting truthful data about human kindness. Next, we have a story entitled Following a Wandering Star by Paul McCartney. John Lennon's observation that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus earned him full immersion in fire and brimstone, though he might have also been accused of understatement. Timothy Leary, the Harvard professor and LSD apostle, took a more expansive view, insisting that the Fab Four were mutants and prototypes of evolutionary agents sent by God to create a young race of laughing freemen. All things must pass, as George Harrison observed, and individual popularity was fleeing after the Beatles disbanded in 1970. Starting anew, even for musical deities, can be a bumpy road. The first decade of Paul McCartney's second act is fully illuminated in Wings, the story of a band on the run, an oral history drawn from interviews with band and family members, as well as other interested party, and edited by Ted Widmer. Mr. McCartney opens the book with a brief overview of his life immediately after the Beatles. The tumor was that he was dead. Not quite. He and his wife Linda had holed up on their Scotland farm, where he learned to pour cement and shear sheep, while she worked on her music ship and cooking. His solo comeback took off with the song Maybe I'm Amazed in 1970, a vigorous ode to Linda, followed by the number one hit Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, in 1971, a strangely memorable song whose meaning remains elusive after decades of listening. The album Ram, which came out in 1971, was nuked by John Landau, the Rolling Stone critic, who called it the nadir in the decomposition of 60s rock and incredibly inconsequential and monumentary irrelevance. The wounded Mr. McCartney got depressed, he recalls, and found himself wondering, can I make a decent record? When Wings, created in 1971, released its first album, Wildlife, in 1971, Mr. McCartney discovered the bluebirds were still circling. It got slammed. Touring was the way forward. His attempt to get the Beatles back on the road during the Let It Be sessions was vetoed by Lennon. I think you're daft, was Lennon's reply. But Wings' initial tour, which began in 1972, was deft and a triumph of seat-of-the-pants improvisation. There were no booking agents or scheduled performances. The band simply showed up at various universities and asked if they could play. The ticket price, 50p. It was very rough and ready, Mr. McCartney acknowledges. We had 11 songs, some of which had to be repeated to fill out a gig. The subsequent Wings Over Europe tour rolled forth in a bus whose top speed was 38 miles an hour, but the band reached its own cruising speed and stayed there many years. The story is augmented by timeliness that add a contextual charm all their own. Shortly after the Bloody Sunday killings in January 1972, Mr. McCartney shook up the authorities with the Wings release of Give Ireland Back to the Irish, a song banned by the BBC. On February 10, 1972, 2 days after Wings hit the road, David Bowie started touring as Ziggy Stardust. 11 days later, Richard Nixon arrived in China to see if Mao Zedong was up for a thaw. On June 18th, Mr. McCartney celebrated his 30th birthday, the day before the five men had been arrested for breaking into Democratic National Committee's headquarters at the Watergate, all of which might suggest the cosmic stage manager also likes playing a hit a bit by ear. Wings the Corb, which was formed by the McCartneys and Denny Lane, that is the Moody Blues former guitarist, was augmented by various sidemen following a wandering star that took them to many interesting places, none more so than in 1973, a recording studio in Lagos, Nigeria. Mr. McCartney recalls pilots scanning the jungle in search of the airport and wondering, there was no instrument guidance. Is that it over there? They were greeted by millions of bugs. A half a dozen assailants later robbed the McCartneys. A bronchial spasm sent the maestro to the hospital. Yet diversity and dividends. The resulting album, Band on the Run, 1973, which includes the hit Jet, would win two Grammys. The book brims with often captivating details. A 1974 visit with Lennon during Lennon's last weekend in Los Angeles included an invitation from Harry Nilsson for Mr. McCartney to sample Elephant Tranquilizer, which he declined. Abbey Road was published in 1969, was initially to be called Everest after the engineer's favorite brand of cigarettes, which would have sparred countless people countless hours of analyzing the album's Street Crossing cover shot. Mr. McCartney also recalls writing a song called Suicide at the same time he wrote When I'm 64 in 1967, with the hope that it might be covered by Frank Sinatra. The chairman of the board apparently considered Suicide DOA. Wings played his final gig at the Concert for the People of Kampuchea on December 29, 1979, followed by Mr. McCartney's marijuana arrest in Japan and a canceled tour. That took the wind out of Wings, but it had been a good flight. Hard times were lurking. Lennon was murdered on December 8, 1980, and Little McCartney died of breast cancer in 1998. But the show always went on. Along the way, Mr. McCartney had hits with Michael Jackson, Rihanna, Kanye West, and Stevie Wonder. He eventually married a tracking company executive for whom he wrote My Valentine in 2012, which Cole Porter might have envied. These days, Mr. McCartney often drives 20 minutes to a studio near his home to work on new material. I take great pleasure from routine, he writes, a routine that includes a touring life that had stretched to more than 65 years. At a recent Columbus, Ohio concert, an attending friend tells me the 83-year-old played nearly 3 hours without a break. Timothy Leary might have been onto something. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Services. Now, in conjunction with the holidays approaching, this next article is entitled A Catalog of Object Lessons. The Heart-Shaped Ten is a book by B. Wilson. The cherished objects with which we surround ourselves can reveal much about us. The things we keep and use in the kitchen especially can conjure powerful memories, aromatic reminders of nurturing care and loving connections, as well as less savory bites of deprivation, regret, disappointment, and loss. B. Wilson's own painful memories were triggered by the clang of a heart-shaped baking tin falling to the floor. 2 months earlier, the man to whom she was married to for 23 years abruptly left her for another woman. In the past, this whimsically shaped object evoked only joy. Now its crash was like a death knell. It wasn't just any cake tin. It was the heart-shaped tin I had used to bake my own wedding cake. Miss Wilson, a British chef and food author, explains in her wise, engaging memoir. She had treasured the pan through the years as a keepsake of her love. Now her ex-husband's actions declared he no longer had any love left for her to keep. The disconnect paralyzed her. What to do with this inanimate object whose newly visible rust spots Miss Wilson began to equate with the crack she had failed to discern in her marriage? Her friends urged her to reframe the tin's meaning. Make it a tool of healing instead of hurt, they suggested. Strip it of its associations with betrayal and embrace it as a symbol of resilience. As a how-to-heal solution, it was both visible and valid. It was also a task more easily advised than accomplished. But Miss Wilson, who was accustomed to working and reworking recipes until they were perfected, was intrigued by how and why an inanimate object would become so emotionally intertwined with her very own. The more I asked around, the more I saw that feeling emotion about kitchen objects was the rule rather than the exception, even for people who were not especially interested in cooking, she writes. I wasn't alone in having intense and even magical feelings about the things I cooked and ate with. Actually, bear to use because it reminds you too strongly of the person who gave it to you. It's only when we feel mended enough that we can set aside or repurpose the object that made us feel broken. Miss Wilson recounts more than 30 of the stories she gathered from people around the powerful lure their crockery seemed to possess. Each tale focuses on a different kitchen object, sometimes luxurious, more often mundane, almost always unlikely. For Kate McDermott, a baker and author of Art of the Pie, which was published in 2016, no cooking implement is as irreplaceable as her happy hands. Stainless steel salad tongs that feature marionette-shaped hands clapping together as if giving applause when grabbing food. A gift her mother received as a wedding present in 1943. The tongs symbolize from Miss McDermott the brief years of family happiness before her father's illness and death before her mother's forced her to follow a humiliatory, strict diet and delegated to her the daily task of cooking. The happy hands became Miss McDermott's solace and her souvenir, and later, when her son developed his own fondness for them as mother and son cooked and baked together, a renewed source of happiness. If her son and his wife have children, the happy hands, Miss McDermott hopes, will carry on its magic to another generation. For Rupa Gulati, a chef and food writer, the news of her husband's brain tumor forced her to rethink her connection to the China dinner service her parents reserved for only the most special of occasions. Fearful she might accidentally break a dish, Miss Gulati had not removed the dinner service from her attic in years, but her husband's diagnosis reminded her of life's brevity and that every remaining day of their lives together should be cause for celebration. One way to celebrate was to use these beautiful, cared-for dishes at every meal. Instead of being stored like museum pieces, Miss Wilson writes, the plates now shine on the table like sacred vessels. Cooking tools can even help carry us back home. The Latin American griddle known as budar that Sasha Correa's father gave her before she left Venezuela for Spain kept her connected to her homeland, her family, and her heritage. Similarly, when Mrs. Wilson's mother died only months after her husband's departure, she discovered that her mother's former kitchen implements possessed the power to reconnect mother and daughter, if only in memory. Perhaps the most profound story here belongs to Jacob Chaim, who, during his years in a Nazi-forced labor camp, secretly crafted a small tin spoon that would come to affirm his sense of humanity. After the war, he took the spoon with him when he moved to Canada, where he donated it to the Montreal Holocaust Museum. The museum's website says that Chain created the spoon because Nazi guards, to dehumanize Jewish inmates, did not provide cutlery to eat their small food rations. Ms. Wilson notes, what it does not say is that in Hebrew, the name Chaim means life. The book ends as it begins with the heart-shaped tin. Some 3 years after her husband's exit, Ms. Wilson brings the tin out of storage to bake a birthday cake in celebration with her three grown children of her 50th birthday. The tin has not changed, she realized, but she has, and so has her understanding of the ways in which she can use it to express love, affection, and the ties that bind people together. The tin was only an inanimate object, but in reframing its meaning, she has reopened her heart. Scott Eyman writes, in a hurry to the top, great actors change every time we see them, but the great movie stars succeed on the strength of the personas they carry from film to film. The personas can also serve consciously or unconsciously as a wall. Scott Eyman faces a triple challenge in his richly engrossing biography of Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. He has to lead the readers past the barricade of Mommy Dearest, which was published in 1978, a book written by her daughter, Christina Crawford, that was made into a 1981 Frank Perry movie, both of which portray the actress as an abusive mother. Then he has to guide the reader over the obstacle of Crawford's own late career camp cartoon performances, and after that he has to penetrate the steely street goddess persona of the star's 1930s prime, a collaboration between the MGM Dream Factory and the actress herself. Somewhere under all this, there's a real person, living, breathing human woman. Mr. Byman finds her. Crawford was the classic era movie star who had the largest career at the top. She had her first hit in the silent era. Her petulant act job was in a night gallery episode directed by a young Steven Spielberg. She was also the star who most doggedly and forcefully created her public image. A Woman's Face tracks Crawford from her 1906 birth in Texas as Lucille LeSueur to her youth in Oklahoma and Kansas City as Billy Kaysen. Mr. Eyman draws a picture of an increasingly resentful child dragged through a succession of cow towns and surrogate fathers. It was, he writes, a childhood and adolescence not so much of abject poverty as of poverty of outlook, of ambition, and the girl got out as soon as she could. Crawford's rise to fame was so fast it surprised even her. From Dancing in Detroit in April 1924 to a chorus line on Broadway a month later to a movie contract that December under the segue of MGM producer Harry Ruff, who may or may not have been her lover. Along the way, Ruff held a fan contest to pick the new star, a new name, after three contestants chose Joan Arden. The studio picked Crawford to avoid paying three separate cash prizes. The actress hated it, but the young starlet made friends with everyone in every department at the studio and learned what they all did in the evenings. She made the rounds of the Hollywood clubs, taking the dance floor by storm. Crude as she was, everything about her seemed to say, look out. I'm in a hurry, make room, said one MGM onlooker after appearing as the love interest in a Harry Langdon comedy and as the Imperial Female in 1927, The Unknown, where she learned from star Lon Chaney a fierce focus that extended to her performances on and off screen. Crawford hit it big as a jazz age hillion in 1927's Our Dancing Daughters. The MGM brass realized Ms. Eyman's rights that she possessed something valuable, an electric charge that made an audience sit up and take notice. Crawford survived the transition to talking pictures, one of the few silent stars to do so, and proved herself as a star and an actress amid all the star scrum of 1932's Grand Hotel. Then she embarked on a run of films that remain her most impressive and important work. As a mirror to Depression-era women with lives much like hers had been, the actress was an indispensable cinematic representative whose clothes, hairstyles, makeup, and flirty yet heart-scrum attitude marked her as a forerunner to today's internet influencers. Her best partner on screen and on and off lover was Clark Gable. His working class sensuality matched up well with Crawford's female version of the same quality. They were mutts who regarded themselves as lucky to have been adopted out of the proud pound of MGM. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 22nd, 23rd issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal Review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader has been Don Bolin. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the New York Times. Following that at 9 o'clock is Fortune Magazine. And at 10 o'clock, we have 6 episodes of The Fat Man and an old-time radio holiday special. Stay with us for these readings and more. If you or people you know shop at any of the Dash's supermarkets, please save Dash's register tapes for radio reading. Our agency receives $2 for every $100 in Dash's register tapes. Radio reading has raised thousands of dollars so far. Anyone can drop off their Dash's tapes to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, between William and Clinton Streets. Or Dash's tapes can be mailed to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service at 1199 Harlem Road, Cheektowaga, New York, 14227. Any questions on Dash's tapes for radio reading? Call us at 716-821-5555, and thanks for caring. following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print.